Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive functions. This show is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. These conversations will introduce mental tools that will empower you to shift your mindset for a successful life. And now, here's your host, Sucheta Kamath.
All right, and welcome back to Full Prefrontal, where we are exposing the mysteries of executive function. I am here again with our host, Sucheta Kamath. Good morning, my friend. I am very much looking forward to your second conversation with Dr. Bob Brooks. But before we go there, you're going to tell me about a dog bite, an ER visit, and parenting, and how all of that, what does it have to do with leading to a self-disciplined child?
Yes. So let me start with a story of a friend of mine. Let's call him Eric. You know, it was an ordinary Sunday morning at his home, and the parents and three kids congregated in the kitchen for a delicious Sunday breakfast. And suddenly, from nowhere, their beautiful baby boy was viciously attacked by their own domesticated pet dog. As Eric recalls it, it happened very fast. He remembers getting the dog away in just a few seconds. But by the time he pulled his son away, the dog had bitten his son's ear off. So right away, the family rushed to the children's hospital, and Eric's son received immediate attention and proper care. But those were some intense moments. And Eric and his family kept saying to themselves, it could have been a lot worse. And they settled with the thought that it was all going to be okay. But I could tell that the guilt the dad was feeling to see the young boy going through so much pain and what's to come. Throughout this ordeal, you know, Eric was posting some posts on Facebook. That's how I found out what happened next. But you could tell that they were beginning to adjust. He would post some pictures about their fun visits to the doctor and nurses and even an epic bingo game. You know, the family left the hospital with thumbs up from the doctors, and the prognosis was said to be favorable. Eric continued to post that 3 weeks follow-up revealed that there was progress made, but a much longer road than they had anticipated. Doctors advised Eric to wait until next summer to begin the reconstruction process, which was going to take another 6 to 8 months for the little boy to be fully recovered. So I could see that he and his family were taking baby steps in making the recovery and adjusting and adapting. You know, it was cute. One of the posts, he said that the best news today was that the young boy could now go back to the pool. Yeah, so they were celebrating even simple achievements such as being able to get into the water. You know, the last post, particularly as I make reference in this podcast, ended with a wonderfully positive note that he says, meanwhile, we will be investing in a world-class headband collection, you know. So what was truly heartwarming for me that this was a family in crisis, but their response was extremely resilient. You know, we all have heard that when life gives lemons, you make a lemonade. But how do we do that? And this story captures the essence of that, you know, having a positive outlook and having much needed optimism. And research shows that parents who respond to crisis like that certainly help aid in the child becoming self-reliant and self-sufficient. And so humans respond to life's events as they know best. This response is known as adaptive skills, but there is a thin line between adaptive response, which proves to be life-saving, versus maladaptive response, which proves to be life-damaging. And how do we distinguish between the two? And how do we inhabit the life-saving adaptive behaviors and inculcate them into our daily life? Well, that's what we're going to talk about. And those who heard my amazing speaker last week, Dr. Robert Brooks, he returns to talk about that self-disciplined child. So Dr. Robert Brooks is a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School. He serves there in part-time capacity, and he was a former director of the Department of Psychology at McLean Hospital, a private psychiatric hospital. He has lectured nationally and internationally and has written extensively about such themes as motivation, resilience, schoolwork, school and work climate, parenting and family relationship, and balancing our personal and professional lives. I personally have heard him speak many times and seen his demonstrations in his workshops and have read, I wouldn't say all 17 books, but at least 3 books really well. He has co-authored and authored 17 books. They include Raising Resilient Child, The Power of Resilience, Handbook of Resilience in Children, and so on and so forth. So it's my pleasure to have him on this segment today, because we will be spending time and discussing how do we help them help our children or our students become self-disciplined.
17 books. Goodness gracious. Well, like last week, this promises to be yet another important and great episode. So very much looking forward to it. Let's get to it. Here is Sucheta's second conversation with Dr. Bob Brooks.
Dr. Robert Brooks, welcome back to Full Prefrontal, Exposing the Mysteries of Executive Function. I am very delighted to have you, and this is our second interview. And this time, I would love to talk a little bit about raising self-disciplined children. So my question was, executive function is nothing but self-directed attention to control impulses, to manage goals, so that the future you benefits from the self-refrain you have shown in the current moment. In the field of psychology or cognitive neuroscience, social psychology, and even education, we use different terms to describe executive function. Since we are here to talk about your expertise as to how to help children become more self-disciplined, how do you see that defined, and how do you describe these skills?
For me, one of the most important qualities in being resilient is self-discipline, which basically implies ownership for your own behavior. It's the person who's self-disciplined thinks before they act. They reflect about different options that they have. They are often very empathic because they take into consideration how their actions are going to impact on other people. It is just such a basic skill. And after my colleague and I, Sam Goldstein, wrote our book, Raising Resilient Children, we then wrote the book, Raising a Self-Disciplined Child, because we wanted to focus even more on the importance of discipline in being resilient and leading a more successful life. And that we found that there were key skills in terms of resilience that are really involved in terms of self-discipline, like, you know, thinking before one acts or reflecting on different situations that may arise. And there's a lot of research to show that children who are self-disciplined, the young children, as they get older, are going to fare much better in school and in different situations than children who really act before they think. Given the importance of discipline, there's been some wonderful research, some of it goes back now 30, 40 years, looking at discipline styles used by the adults in a child's life, and only one of which really goes along with helping kids be more resilient. The research showed there was what they call the authoritarian adult. Basically, that was the adult who said, you do it because I'm your mother or father, or I'm your teacher. Very little teaching that went on or learning about why you do certain things. And these were longitudinal studies that found kids who grew up in authoritarian homes often were very poor problem solvers, were more impulsive. Then there was the parent who was much more called permissive. They could be loving parents, but they did not set guidelines or limits for whatever reason. Sometimes they thought that their children wouldn't love them. And in those cases, some of these kids grew up to be very entitled. And there was an interesting thing that they also found was some of these kids actually felt they weren't loved, because any child, they won't say this, really wants to grow up in a home where they don't want to feel more powerful than the parents in the home. A third parent was the neglectful. These kids had the worst outcome as adults. They basically were neglected. The parents almost did nothing but showed no love or anything. And so the kids really grew up feeling worthless. And the fourth parent, and I know I'm spending a little time on this, but I spent quite a lot of time researching it. The fourth parent is what any parent or teacher, any caregiver wants to strive towards. It was called the authoritative, not the authoritarian, the authoritative. These were parents who held kids accountable, who felt disciplining children was a very important part of the parenting, process. But they did so with a great deal of love. They did so the kids understood within reason, you know, why there are certain consequences. They used what we call natural and logical consequences. These kids grew up to be the most resilient, the best problem solvers. So what I always say when I go over these different parenting or disciplinary forms, I would say, let's strive much more towards the authoritative, because these are the kids who are going to really be much more flexible, much better problem solvers, and take greater ownership for their own behavior.
Thank you for spelling each one of them out. So I have a question about this authoritative parents meeting an executive dysfunctional child, you know, child who is is very impulsive, lacks the self-discipline, you know, loses the, you know, forest for the trees, is kind of in the moment, very resistant. Does the parenting style get influenced by the pushback from the child gives, or were these parents able to sustain their behaviors no matter what the what kind of child they met?
Do we know anything about that? Yeah, I'm laughing because I see that all the time in my clinical practice. It's very easy to think one is a good parent when our children say, "I am so fortunate to be a member of this household." Which, of course, if a child said that, we would have to really wonder. What you're bringing up is such an important concept in psychology. There's a concept called goodness of fit, and what it is each child comes in with his or her own temperament, and parents have to really accommodate to some extent and adapt to the child. If not, they're going to lock horns. So if a child comes into the world with very self-disciplined parents and that child has an easygoing temperament and, you know, really is able to learn to think before they act, then there's typically not going to be a problem. What you're bringing up is when we have kids, if we're a parent whose style is maybe very different from ours, you know, we remain calm, you know, we're calm or whatever, and the child is not. But what I say to parents is we really have to look at what we could do differently. And that doesn't mean not holding the child accountable, but we have to do it in a way that takes into consideration what the child's temperament is. It's the same thing in schools. There are some kids who, especially teachers, have kids with all different temperaments in a class. Some kids come to school much better prepared, given their disciplinary, you know, their self-discipline, given their temperament, given their learning style, much better prepared to succeed at school than others. But then we have to think this way. If a child comes to school, we have to be careful not to blame the child. We have to be careful to stop using words like this kid doesn't care. And these are actual words I've heard. This kid is lazy. This kid is unmotivated. Instead, what we have to ask is, how do I meet a child's needs who is not as easily self-disciplined? What are some of the things I could say or do? I've worked with many kids with learning and attentional problems over the years and hyperactive kids. And it's not easy for the adults in their lives, and it's not easy for a teacher. But over the years, you know, I've developed different strategies to help, because we have to get out of the mindset a child is doing this on purpose and instead say every child is very, very different and some will take much longer to develop self-discipline and self-control.
Yeah, and I second that. I think in my practice, I see that the good faith, parents begin their parenting with great belief that everything I'm doing is very intentional and is going to work. And they themselves are not prepared for the pushback or the child's temperament, and some of them handle it well and some of them don't. No. And then them not handling well really makes the child's problem worse than keeps it the same. That's the part is a challenge, I feel.
Oh, yeah. Years ago, I said in a talk, parents take too much credit for their kid's success and too much blame for their kid's difficulties. And what I meant, why I said it was that each child comes in with a very unique temperament. I mean, there's all this research now to show that. And they come in with a unique learning style. What you're bringing up is the support that parents need when their best efforts, they're not necessarily seeing the results they would like to see with the kids. Teachers often feel, you know, the same way. Therapists could feel the same way. So some of the parents I see, or those who come to some of my workshops, are feeling very frustrated because they really feel they've exhausted every strategy, they've tried everything, and then it leads them into having a much more negative mindset, which may be, I'm not a very good parent, that's why my child acts this way, or my child just, you know, is not a very nice kid, and soon we're giving different labels to the behavior, rather than recognizing that, and this is a point I make in all my workshops, and I emphasize it because of the questions I received, is I go over the research on temperament and I say, some kids are born with easier temperaments, some kids are born with what they call slow to warm up or cautious, and some kids are born with, again, not to use an overly negative term, but that's what researchers have used, a more difficult temperament. And, you know, and what I say to people is, but we as parents, that's why I brought up the notion of goodness of fit, have to say, okay, how can I reach my child here? Like, to give you an example, I found more than a lot of kids who are more impulsive, when you're working out ways to help them be less impulsive, they often forget. And then you tell them again and they say, you're nagging me. Well, one of the techniques I've used with teachers and with parents is to say to a child, even as an adult, I may forget a rule or I may forget something. If I do, this is how I would like you to remind me. And you give them one or two ways to that you want to be reminded, because then they're going to be more receptive to hearing the following. How would you like me to remind you, the parent or teacher says to the child, if you should forget a rule or if I see certain behavior that we're working on? When the child can come up with how they would like to be reminded in terms of changing certain behavior, it's their idea. They're much more willing to then accept the feedback. And, you know, so I say to parents, some kids, you're going to be able to give them feedback and they feel much more comfortable. Others, you have to think about. It gets to, you know, the notion we discussed in the last episode on empathy. How do you say things in a way where you're going to really help to develop self-control and self-discipline in kids? And part of it, you have to recognize that kids are going to push back. And I always say to parents, try to think of it as this is a kid's style and they're just, it's not that they're out to get you.
You know, so this reminds me of this conversation that I think, again, it's almost a calling. Like, how can you be a psych wise person? You know, how are you going to be this wise person who has great astute understanding of human psychology? And if you don't have that, you are going to muck it up a little bit with your children, with your colleagues, yeah. Or
even if you do, you know, with my own older son, who's very successful today, he did no work in school in the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grades. And I did not handle it very well. You know, I became much more punitive. It was very upsetting. And, you know, looking back,
I have a hard time believing that you would be punitive or hard on him.
Punitive in the following. The moment I would come home from work every day, we're at the hospital, I was Dr. Empathy, basically. The first question I would ask is, did you do your homework today? Right away, it's at a very negative tone. You know, I kid with parents because they say, well, we say that. I said, well, how would you feel when you came home from work if the first thing your kid said to you is, did you finish all your work at work today? Because if you didn't, there's no television for you tonight. And if you worked harder, we could live better. And people, you know, laugh. But what happens is, it's something I said in the other episode, is it's very easy to be empathic when our kids are really doing what we would like them to do. The true test is when they're not. So instead of being problem solving with my son and saying, you know, what is it we could do? Instead of seeing his strengths, while he wasn't doing his schoolwork, he was teaching reading at a homeless shelter. He was president of the youth group in our town.
Oh, wow.
So that is the other thing, which I haven't talked as much about resilience, but, you know, I use the metaphor of islands of competence. And anytime we're working with kids or raising kids, certainly we can see the difficulties, but we also have to make sure we never lose sight of their beauty or strengths or their islands of competence. And, you know, the other segment we did about resilience, one of the things I always ask parents is, what do you see as your son or daughter's strengths or beauty or their islands of competence? Because it's so easy, especially since people are coming to see me because their kids are having difficulty, it's so easy to just focus on what the problems are. But you'll never solve problems if you don't also focus on what the strengths or islands of competence are of kids. And I also ask parents what they see as their own islands of competence. So yes, I was punitive in the sense that I took things away. Well, you didn't do you got a warning slip, then this is taken away. Rather than really trying to sort out what was going on and also appreciating all the wonderful things my son was doing.
Thank you for explaining that, because that just, first of all, reminds me that you're a human, because you're an expert, and you sharing your own difficulties with your child makes me feel that, you know, there are many ways I have screwed up with my sons. And as I've developed some wisdom and awareness, I do apologize to them sometimes for being harsh and critical and demanding of them. Well, in closing, I have a question for you. So I see a lot of challenges many parents struggling with, which is how do we balance this act of giving feedback about their strengths and their weaknesses? So there are lots of things kids are doing right, But I think sometimes I feel kids are on this treadmill where they have to accomplish even more than what they did yesterday. And parents feel, if I just waste my time complimenting you on what you did yesterday, which was expected 2 days ago, you're just going to be so behind. So there's a rat race mentality or fear of being behind. And a lot of times there's not enough celebration that happens of a child. You talked a little bit about how you did it with your son, but can you give some advice to parents as we close?
Wow. Your comment really, I said this before, one of your comments triggered a great deal. One of the things is I wish, you know, as one mother once said to me, whose son was having a lot of trouble. Now, this is years later, he's doing very well. She said, I wish I had a crystal ball. So one of the things I always say is, one could not necessarily predict how a kid is at 10 or 11 or 12, how they're going to necessarily turn out. I don't want to make that a black and white kind of statement, but some kids really start to shine a little later in life than other kids. And I wish we didn't worry quite as much. As Daniel Goleman said, there's really very little correlation between high school grades and success later in life as measured in a whole host of things. Also, what it brought up is, we have to be very judicious with our compliments about our kids. But as I say that, it's one thing to compliment a child and getting a good grade or whatever. But some of the most important things we could do for parents is to create those moments when kids feel, and I hope I don't sound corny in saying this, really we accept them for who they are, not what we want them to be, and we show unconditional love. In my books, I write about very powerful moments. You know, you take your kid out. You know, I could think when I had season tickets for the Boston Celtics and I shared it with other families and just going out to a game and how important it was. I felt that better than any compliments about grades is every Wednesday when my kids were growing up, probably between the ages when they were, you know, 7 or 8 to about, or 6 or whatever, to about into their teenage years, actually. I would take one out for dinner and the next week the other, and my wife would also alternate. And it doesn't mean you have to go out to dinner, but it was nice just to get out of the house. We didn't go anywhere fancy. And it was just so nice to sit with each son alone. I have two sons, and just chat with them. And my older son had a rule. We couldn't talk about school. He was the one who wasn't doing his homework. And I said, that's fine. What I didn't say is because I don't want to get indigestion. So let's just talk about, you know, other things. So we create these very special moments that really that help a child. When these moments are created, then it's easier for us to speak about some of the difficulties they may be having. Another, just I want to add, I started saying to parents, ask your kids this. Do you think I'm nagging you? Almost every child will say yes and say, well, I'm glad I asked because I don't want to nag you. So we have to figure out how I can speak with you about certain things that don't seem like nagging. Now you turn it into problem solving again. By the way, these were not things I did with my own kids. It's helpful to others. And of course, along the way, more and more, I started asking, how do you create those interactions where kids are going to be more likely to hear you? And when they're more likely to hear you, they're going to start really assuming some of the values, the important values you have, and they're going to become more self-disciplined.
I love the way you just translated this unconditional love. What does that look like? Is one, it looks like that you view them as complete, full, all that they can be, they already are, not waiting to see that happen and only then offering something of you. And second thing is, I think you're talking a lot about respect. I think kids, parents sometimes forget to respect their kids.
definitely. It is a certain level of respect. And it's... The first part, you know, it's really accepting them. Acceptance doesn't mean, someone said, does that mean you let kids do whatever they want? No, acceptance really has to do with this unconditional love. See, for a while, I had conditional love for my son, my older son, Rich. It was almost like, not that I said it, but I acted it. You know, I would love you more if you didn't have all these warning slips coming home on that. But I fail to see other things. And that doesn't mean if he came home with, you know, 4 Fs, I mean, there's a real problem there. He always passed his classes. But it was really, I almost saw it as a reflection of my parenting, the negative, the bad things, I'll say, like, I mean, the warning slips. And yet there were so many positive qualities. So the notion of respect is a very, very important one. And it's rooted in our ability to be empathic, understand our kids, and recognize, and this is the last point I'll make, there are many different paths that different kids take for, I'll say, success in life. And there's not one path. I've known kids who were straight A students who had a lot of difficulty and were very stressed out. And I've known kids who, as adults, if you would have never guessed that they were C students or struggled in school and are doing very well now. So we always have to be careful in assuming that there's one path, that good grades lead to this, or being a great athlete leads to this. There are many factors that contribute to a person's happiness and success in life.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for being this wonderful, charismatic adult, not just for your children, but for so many of us out there, and particularly those who are trying to do their best to not just raise kids, but really educate kids and bring out the best in those who are struggling. So I cannot thank you enough for being here today and really sharing your wisdom so generously. So I full-heartedly thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure to have someone interview me who offers so many insights and comments and makes it easy to be interviewed. So thank you.
So once again, that was Dr. Bob Brooks, another stellar conversation with him, Sucheta. Lots to think about here. Gosh, lead us off with this idea of, help us understand the relationship between resilience and self-discipline.
Yeah, great question, Todd. You know, I love these takeaways because they actually compel me to reflect, because when you're with the guest speaker, you know, you are firing your questions, you're responding to their comments, and you're thinking through. But as I look back and I gather my thoughts and share my personal takeaways, as well as I'm here to really help people bring this knowledge into their clinical life, their classroom teachings, or even their personal discipline with their children at home. And I always think, how can we apply this? You know, how can we apply this wisdom? So I think, you know, Bob jumped into this because we were focused on talking about self-disciplined child, but I want to kind of connect that back a little bit more concretely to resilience. So let me start with the overview of the concept of resilience, because in this podcast, the concept of self-disciplined child has the foundation of resiliency. So resilience in literature typically refers to children who have demonstrated capacity to overcome difficult situations, such as poverty, abuse, neglect, or even academic failure, in such a way that they have moved on to lead more satisfying and well-adjusted lives. The key ingredient to their success has turned out to be a resilient mindset. Such a mindset includes characteristics and skills, including the following. You know, they believe that there is at least one adult, charismatic adult, you know, who relates to their plight and offers unconditional love and is always present with great support and encouragement. And this presence is palpable to the child. The second key component is that these children are optimistic and they view mistakes as an opportunity from which they can learn. And they don't look at mistakes as something that's permanent and a trait about themselves. The third thing is they are self-aware and they have great sense of their strengths. The next thing is that these kids are excellent problem solvers. And the last and the most relevant to our discussion today is that these kids demonstrate great self-discipline. And so, you know, Bob explained, and I'm quoting here, that a self-disciplined individual is the one that takes ownership of their own behaviors. So how do they demonstrate that they have taken ownership? Number one, they think before they act. Number two, they reflect upon the myriad of choices that they face and they evaluate them very carefully. Three, they review and determine the best option. They're not impulsive to choose the first one and move on. And last, fundamentally, these individuals are empathic. They're good at seeing the situation from somebody else's point of view, and they give deep consideration to how do their actions impact others. So these are the key components of self-disciplined child, self-disciplined individual, and this self-discipline, being self-disciplined, is a part of this bigger picture of resiliency. So that's the takeaway for me, that resiliency and self-disciplined behaviors are so deeply intertwined.
Well, what's quite fascinating about this whole discussion is knowing that the way parents treat their children directly influences whether or not that child is self-disciplined or not. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and it always fascinates me in my practice that when parents bring their children and they have, particularly they always come to me because they are struggling, you know, they are impulsive, they don't have good habits, they are a little bit difficult to deal with, they have a lot of failures in academic context, but they're not motivated to fix them. And the parents bring them and present them as if, look at all the problems that my child is facing. And I have to be very gentle and careful, but I also like to remind them, just like Bob was talking about, that there are certain elements to their disciplinary style that's impacting the way the child is responding to his own inabilities or challenges, you know. And so I know this is a little repetitious, but it'll be great to just talk about these four kinds of parents or adults that he was talking about. One is the authoritarian, second was the permissive parent, the third was neglectful parent, and the last one, but the most critical one, the authoritative parent. And what I find in the first three that doesn't cast the right impact is they lack the wisdom in parenting in a way. You know, so going back to that self-disciplined child who knows how to think before he acts, you know, who knows how to view options and who has a tremendous capacity to take other points of views into consideration. But authoritarian adult is always very preachy. You know, he believes that I'm right and you must follow me. You know, there's no explanation provided of how to follow and why to follow what's been advised. And so as a result, the child turns out to be a poor problem solver. You take the permissive parent, you know, who is afraid that children will hate me, you know, if I am a strong parent, or they actually, they don't set any guidelines or limits on these children. And what ends up to be is that the children actually turn out to be more entitled human beings. But unfortunately, the underneath the surface is that these children don't feel that they were loved. And that's such a loss because that is not the parent's intention. But the way it affects the self-disciplined nature is that these children develop this understanding that they have more power in a relationship and they don't mind taking advantage of that and not to work hard, because being self-disciplined is saying no. And who wants to say no, right? And the third kind of parent, of course, that doesn't work is the neglectful parent. Parent who doesn't have any expectations and doesn't have any supervision or guidelines. You know, they are disengaged parents. And of course, that's a terrible idea for teaching the child or modeling for the children how to solve problems. And of course, so that leaves us to this authoritative parent who has it right. They are very invested in their child, but they are very clear about the expectations. So that's the right way to go. And I can say, you know, I was raised by authoritative parents. It was not a picnic, but I was explained a lot of life principles, and I was shown why things matter and how we should care and how to be good people. And I was always, you know, parents came back and checked on me whether I did what I was supposed to do or not. And there were consequences, there were punishments, and there were reprimands, but they did not fail in the domain of unconditional love. So yes, I have personally firsthand experience in this domain.
All right. So in the conversation, Dr. Brooks was also talking about temperament and goodness of fit. So what are those and how do they relate to one another?
Yeah, I love the reference Bob made to the concept of goodness of fit. You know, each child presents with a unique set of skills, gifts, and temperament, which influences their response style. You know, certain types of temperaments eventually formulate, in my opinion, the fixed mindset. You know, I've had this guest, Sam Goldstein, who has co-authored the book on self-disciplined child. And in one of the articles that he wrote, Dr. Goldstein describes the temperament finds its origin from the Latin word temperamentum, which is a correct mixture. And he says that temperament consists of the inborn qualities that children bring to the world. Just as children possess different physical and cognitive features, they also possess different temperaments. And these inborn qualities determine how children will respond to the world and in many ways shape and influence the way the world responds to them. Temperament impacts children's style of learning, their strengths, and their vulnerabilities. And I took that segment from his article because I think it really, really is important for parents, educators, and a specialist to take pay special attention to that. And in their book, Raising Resilient Children, Dr. Goldstein and Bob or Robert Brooks talks about four steps to help parents understand and accept their child's temperament. And I'll just walk people through this. I'll have a link to this article as well in the show notes. But here they are. You know, step one is to become educated. Learn what kids are incapable of and stay away from making assumptions that inability equals willful resistance or manipulation on child's part. Temper your expectations. You know, that's so critical as parents. Step two is measure your mindset. You know, assess your own mindset. Take an inventory of your invisible or intangibles. You know, I like this idea that compare and contrast how you want to respond versus how you actually do respond, and then be willing to change. The third step that they recommend is make necessary adjustments. And you know, that's another very intriguing component, that in order to develop resilience, you have to demonstrate resilience, or in order to promote resiliency, you have to demonstrate a resilient or adaptive adjustment yourself. And so what they recommend, that bring balance to as you move away from the unrealistic expectations. You don't need to give up having any expectations, but tweak your hopes and dreams a little bit. Make sure that the child's success doesn't become a vehicle for you to demonstrate your personal self-worth as a parent. And finally, step four, they recommend is begin the process of collaboration. So the most important role that parents need to take is that they are responsible for bridging the gap between their own aspirations of their child and the reality of the child's skill set. So if they accept this responsibility well, then they will be willing and able to work with the child with that level of acceptance and with a great sense of clarity. So that's how a temperament can be brought into shaping the development of self-disciplined child.
Ah, goodness, lots to think about there. To ponder that a bit more. But let's close on this idea. I mean, talk about empathic parenting. Now, I imagine there are a lot of parents who probably would say they're empathic parents, but maybe not necessarily. So talk more about that idea, please.
Yeah, so now I feel like we have so many terminologies here, right? So that we talked about that authoritative parent who helps student or child become accountable. So now, to me, there needs to be a component of empathy and compassion. You know, if the parents take the time to understand the critical components of a resilient mindset and use that knowledge to guide their interactions with their children, then that itself can lead to strengthening the resiliency in the child. And this will be the reason why their child is going to become independent. And when they face major setback or disappointments, they will know exactly how to respond, and they will feel assured that there's somebody who gets it or gets them and is not going to abandon them or fault them for their mistakes or fault them for having negative experiences. So parents need to adapt, or teachers need to adapt their teaching style with this in mind. And if they do that, they're going to get nothing but amazing response. In my own terms, I like to consider that as psych-wise parenting. You know, parents who demonstrate wisdom that is informed from human psychology. And in order to do that, I think finally the parents need to really, really activate their own empathic stance. And what does that mean? You know, they need to be patient. They need to show patience, not be patient or say, I'm patient. And so they need to, secondly, ask questions, use some prompts to guide during crisis, and check in or help the child check in with their own emotions. How are you feeling? You know, how does this affect your own sense of self? You know, are you okay? When you're angry, what thoughts come to your mind? And once you're angry, what kind of decisions you make? You know, and I completely understand why you blew up because you were angry. Like when you begin to say, I understand, you are giving permission for that child to have endured a mistake or endured a setback. So I think that's such a wonderful way of being a human with another human being, to be empathic.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a skill that a lot of people lack in the workplace, at home, certainly with their children. So lots to think about there as well. Well, goodness, These last 2 weeks with Dr. Brooks have been fascinating. These takeaways, the takeaways are always fascinating, but this week got a lot of homework, lots of things to think about and ponder. Great stuff. All right, all the time we have for today, on behalf of our host, Sucheta Kamath, and all of us at Cerebral Matters, thank you for listening today, and we look forward to seeing you again right here next week on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive functions. To contact our host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive functions, visit her website at CerebralMatters.com. That's CerebralMatters.com. Tune in next week for the next informative episode of Full Prefrontal.